Question Directions, Part B. In Part B of the listening section, you will hear several longer conversations and talks. Each conversation or talk is followed by several questions. The conversations, talks, and questions will not be repeated. The conversations and talks are about a variety of topics. You do not need special knowledge of the topics to answer the questions correctly. Rather, you should answer each question on the basis of what is stated or implied by the speakers in the conversations or talks. For most of the questions, you will need to click on the best of four possible answers. Some questions will have special directions. The special directions will appear in a box on the computer screen. Listen to part of a conversation between two classmates on a college campus.
Did you understand that experiment that Bill mentioned in the group presentation?
The one about free fall?
Right. The one that was conducted on the moon.
Sure. The astronaut held a hammer in one hand and a feather in the other. Then he dropped them at the same time.
And both of them hit the ground at the same time.
Yes. So that proves Galileo's theory that all objects fall at the same rate in the absence of air resistance.
Okay. That was the part that was missing for me, the part about air resistance.
Oh, well, since there is no air resistance on the moon, it is the ideal environment for the experiment.
That makes sense.
Actually, the part that surprised me was how much easier it is to lift the hammer on the moon than it is on Earth, because of the moon's lower rate of gravitational acceleration.
But didn't they say that it was just as difficult to push the hammer along the surface when it fell?
Right again, because gravity only governs vertical motion, like lifting, but not horizontal motion, like pushing.
Thanks for going over this with me.
You're welcome. I really liked the presentation. I think the group did a good job.
18. What are the man and woman talking about? Nineteen. Why is the moon an ideal environment for the experiment? 20. Why was it easier to lift the hammer on the moon? 21. How did the woman feel about the presentation? 22. Listen to a conversation between two college students.
What did you think about the video we were supposed to watch for Professor Stevens' class?
I didn't see it. Was it good?
Really, it was. It was about stress.
How to relieve stress?
Not really. More the effects of stress on the national health.
Oh.
But it was interesting, though.
Really?
Yes, I think they said that 1 out of 9 women aged 45 through 65 will have a heart attack.
I'm surprised at that.
I was, too. Oh, another thing. They said that women usually don't get the same level of care that men do, so the heart attack is likely to be more serious.
Why is that?
Because many members of the medical profession still think of a heart attack as a male problem, so they don't recognize the symptoms in their women patients.
Well, it does sound like an interesting video. I'm going to try to see it before class next time, so I'll be ready for the discussion.
It's on reserve in the library, so you can't check it out, but you can use one of the viewing rooms. It's only an hour long.
22. What was the video about? 23. What did the students learn about women? 24. How did the man feel about the video? 25. What will the woman probably do? 26. Listen to a lecture by an English instructor.
The romance and marriage of Elizabeth Barrett to Robert Browning inspired some of the greatest love poems written in the English language. Elizabeth, without a doubt the greatest woman poet of the Victorian period, was born in Durham County, England, in 1806. Her first important publication was The Seraphim and Other Poems, which appeared in 1838. By 1843, she was so widely recognized that her name was suggested to replace the late poet laureate as the official national poet of England. In part because the sovereign was a woman, there was great support for a movement to break with the tradition of a male poet laureate. Nevertheless, she lost the competition to William Wordsworth. A short time later, she married Robert Browning, himself a gifted poet, and they fled to Florence, Italy. A play, The Barretts of Wimpole Street, recounts their confrontation with Elizabeth's father and their eventual elopement against his wishes. While living in Florence, their only son was born. A year later, in 1850, Elizabeth published her collected works, along with a volume of new poems entitled Sonnets from the Portuguese, so named because her husband often called her his Portuguese. Aurora Leigh, her longest work, appeared in 1856, only 5 years before her death in Italy in 1861.
26. What is the main topic of this lecture? 27. According to the lecturer, what was one reason that Elizabeth Barrett was considered for the title of poet laureate? 28. Where did Elizabeth and Robert Browning live after their elopement? 29. When did Elizabeth Barrett Browning die? 26. Listen to a lecture by a biology instructor.
Today's lecture will include the most outstanding achievements in biology as it relates to the medical sciences. Early in Greek history, Hippocrates began to study the human body and to apply scientific method to the problems of diagnosis and the treatment of diseases. Unlike other physicians of his time, he discarded the theory that disease was caused by the gods. Instead, he kept careful records of symptoms and treatments, indicating the success or failure of the patient's cure. He has been recognized as the father of modern medicine. About a century later, Aristotle began a scientific study of plants and animals, classifying more than 500 types on the basis of body structure. Because of his great contribution to the field, Aristotle has been called the father of biology. By the first century AD, Dioscorides had collected a vast amount of information on plants, which he recorded in the now famous Materia Medica, a book that remained an authoritative reference among physicians for 1,500 years. During the Middle Ages, scientific method was scorned in favor of alchemy. Thus, medicine and biology had advanced very little from the time of the ancients until the 17th century, when the English physician and anatomist William Harvey discovered a mechanism for the circulation of the blood in the body.
30. What is the main topic of this lecture? What was Hippocrates' greatest contribution to medicine? 32. Who is known as the father of biology? 33. What was the contribution made to medicine by William Harvey? 34. Listen to part of a class discussion in a sociology class.
Last class, I asked you to locate some articles about gang activity. Let's just go around the table and share what we found. Tracy, will you begin, please?
Okay. Actually, I did a search of sociological studies on gang activity, and I found that gangs have been prevalent for much longer than I had assumed. I was so surprised. For some reason, I thought that gang activity was a fairly recent phenomenon. But actually, one of the largest studies was carried out by Thrasher in 1936.
Good, good. I'm pleased that you did that. Thrasher's study is a classic research investigation. Can you summarize the findings?
Sure. First, I should say that the study included more than 1,300 gangs with more than 25,000 members. According to Thrasher, a gang is a group that may form spontaneously, but after that will integrate through conflict and violence. Over time, a spirit of solidarity and an attachment to a local territory form. What is most interesting, besides the long history of gangs in the United States, is the fact that not much has changed over the years. And, oh yes, gang behavior seems pretty similar even across cultures.
That is interesting.
Dr. Jackson, may I go next? I have just a brief comment that seems to fit in here.
Please.
Well, another classic study, much later, about 1987 or 8, I think, by Joan Moore, indicated that gang behavior is probably caused by normal adolescent insecurities, the desire for peer approval, respect, support, acceptance, and in some cases, protection if the neighborhood is perceived as dangerous. It seems that gangs take the place of the more childish and acceptable cliques that develop in high schools.
Is it my turn? Well, I looked up the definitions of gang members by police departments and law enforcement agencies. According to the California Youth Gang Task Force, for example, a gang member will be recognizable because of gang-related tattoos, clothing, and paraphernalia like scarves and hats that identify a particular gang and allow others to confirm that the wearer has a right to be on the gang's turf. And to follow up on Tracy's comments about the history of gangs, these criteria have been in place for a long time.
Good job. So far, what I am hearing, though, refers to male gang membership. What about females? Did anyone find any research on their role in gang activity?
I did. Although there are a few girl gangs, females are generally not considered members of the male-dominated gang. They are viewed as more of a support system and an extended social group, friends and girlfriends to party with.
That's what I found, too.
34. What was surprising about Thrasher's study? 35. According to the study by Moore, what causes gang activity? In which two ways are gang members identified by law enforcement authorities? 37. What is the role of women in gangs? 38. Listen to part of a conversation between a student and a professor in the professor's office.
Dr. Brown, could I speak with you for a minute?
Sure, Mary. Come in.
I'm afraid I have a problem.
Oh?
You see, I really like my job here.
That's good, because we really like having you here.
Thank you. But the problem is, I won't be able to work here next semester. You see, I have a problem with my schedule at school.
Well, what exactly is the problem?
I have a required class at 9 o'clock on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Oh, okay. Remind me what your hours are here.
I work from 9 to 1 every day, which has been great because I have been able to schedule all my classes in the afternoon until now.
I see. When does the class end?
It's a 3-hour class, so it meets for an hour 3 times a week.
So you're finished at 10?
Yes, and it would take me half an hour to get here after class. So you see, I would be an hour and a half late on those days.
Well, we need someone 4 hours a day. But how about this? You could come in at 10:30 on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday and work until 2:30 on those days. That would give you a fairly late lunch, but if that's not a problem for you, then we can do it.
That would be great. So I just keep my regular hours on Tuesday and Thursday then.
Right. Listen, Mary, you're a work-study employee, and that means that you have two responsibilities, to work and to study. We know that. As long as you put in the hours to get the job done, we expect to fit your work hours around your school schedule. And don't forget, you can study on the job as long as the work is done first.
38. What is Mary's problem? 39. When is Mary's class next semester? 40. How does Dr. Brown resolve the problem? 41. What is a work-study employee? 42. Listen to part of a lecture in an engineering class. In recent years, we have developed several techniques for building more earthquake-resistant structures. For relatively small buildings, all we have to do is bolt the buildings to their foundations and provide some support walls. These walls are referred to as shear walls in your textbook. They are made of reinforced concrete, and by that I mean concrete with steel rods embedded in it. This not only strengthens the structure, but also diminishes the forces that tend to shake a building during a quake. In addition to the shear walls that surround the building, shear walls can be situated in the center of a building around an elevator shaft or a stairwell. This is really an excellent reinforcement. It is commonly known as a shear core, and it too contains reinforced concrete. Walls can also be reinforced using a technique called cross-bracing. Imagine steel beams that cross diagonally from the ceiling to the floor of each story in a building. Before the walls are finished, you can see a vertical row of steel X's on the structure. Besides steel reinforcements, engineers have also devised base isolators, which are positioned below the building to absorb the shock of the sideways shaking that can undermine a building and cause it to collapse. Most of the base isolators that are currently being used are made of alternating layers of steel and synthetic rubber. The steel is for strength, but the rubber absorbs shock waves. In higher buildings, a moat of flexible materials allows the building to sway during seismic activity. The combination of a reinforced structure and flexible materials has been proven to reduce earthquake damage. But even these engineering techniques are insufficient if the building has been constructed on filled ground. Soil used in filled dirt can lose its bearing strength when subjected to the shock waves of an earthquake, and the buildings constructed on it can literally disappear into the earth. In areas where earthquakes are known to occur, understanding the terrain and using the techniques we have discussed today can greatly reduce property damage and can save lives as well. 42. What is the topic of this lecture? Which technique is used to reinforce walls? 44. Which two materials are used in base isolators? 45. What happens to fill dirt during an earthquake? 46. Listen to part of a lecture in a botany lab. The lab assistant is talking about leaves.
Food and water are carried throughout leaves by their veins. Today, we will be looking at some examples of the main types of vein patterns in leaves. The most common are the pinnate and the palmate. This is a pinnate leaf, which is characteristic of trees like the beech and birch that you see outside this building on campus. Remember that a pinnate leaf has one large central vein called the midrib, with large veins branching off on each side of it. The midrib extends the full length of the leaf. Notice how different this leaf is. This is an example of a palmate leaf from a maple tree. A good way to remember this classification is to think of the palm of your hand. In a palmate leaf, there are several main veins of about equal size that originate at the base of the leaf and extend out to the edge of the leaf, like fingers. A few very narrow leaves are neither pinnate nor palmate. This leaf of grass, for example, has a parallel pattern. Several veins extend themselves from the base of the blade to the tip, as you can see here. Needle leaves are so small that they only have one or occasionally two veins in the center of the needle. I don't have a good slide of a needle leaf, but there is a drawing in your lab manual for you to refer to. Now, I'd like you to turn to Chapter 3 in the manual and use page 52 as a reference for your lab activity. You will find 20 leaves in a plastic bag on your lab table. Please work with your lab partner to classify the veining of each leaf.
46. Which two types represent the most common vein patterns in leaves? 47. According to the lecturer, what is a midrib? 48. How does the lab assistant help students remember the palmate classification? Match the leaves with their vein patterns. 50. What will the students probably do after the short lecture?